You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, October 20th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live. And this is one of the last times we'll get to say this.
Yeah.
In the literal, but not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times as we prepare for our move in the coming weeks.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, on today's program, Danny McLean, she's a freelance reporter, she's going to explain why black women are the key voting bloc in the 2014 midterms, just weeks away. We'll also talk about the Supreme Court upholding Texas's voter suppression efforts. And
also, I will be talking with Brianna Wu. She is a video game developer who is one of the three women who've gone public about what basically the Gamergate movement, if you'd like to call it that, and their harassment.
I don't want to call it that.
Yeah. And their what their harassment has done to her life. It's really a crazy story.
Also, Ted Cruz, apparently the blocked Surgeon General of the United States, is an anti-gun activist. It's an interesting perspective from a troubled man. More on voter suppression. Also, immigrants, refugees, shipped back to Central America, fast-tracked despite their claims of their lives being in danger. They're back in places like Honduras, where in fact their lives are in immense danger. There's a new Human Rights Report on it. Human Rights Watch report on it. We'll talk about that. And study shows that you can actually make your brain more compassionate through meditation. That's interesting. Probably something all of us should try. And what else we got?
Also, white people riot over pumpkins.
And I will address... You know, there's hard truths that we in the white community are not saying to ourselves.
We really need to speak out against white-on-white violence.
I think whether it's the pumpkin riot or really just when a sports team wins, if you're a student at UMass Amherst.
When Scotty B shows up on campus.
Dude! There's a lot of talk about in the white community, and I know that because of some of Matt and I's ethnic heritage, we're not totally plain white, but we still need to take this platform to speak out. Tell you what, really briefly, we're going to get to Danny in a second, Dana, this past weekend, on Twitter, I got dragged into... See, I'm already getting it from all of the, like, Sam Harris people, and I assume that I'll get IMs about that today. Matt and I are actually both working on articles about this for different publications. But I got dragged into the Gamergate thing because I sent out a tweet saying I really resent the fact that now I need to know about video games because apparently some people are so misogynistic and insane that this thing has clearly burst and just become this incredibly big deal. Matt was like totally ahead of the curve on it. And I got inundated, including with like videos explaining the conspiracy to me. And then this Christine Hoff Summers thing, which we should talk about at some point. Like this woman who's like an old school, like she's at the American Enterprise Institute, but she's like, you know, a feminist. It honestly blows my mind how much, like, I don't know, man. Like, I love tennis, but I don't expect everybody else to care about tennis. And I'll say this. And like, but the other day with the Russian, there was a guy in the Russian Tennis Federation said something incredibly racist about the Williams sisters. And therefore, that's a relevant thing to talk about beyond tennis. But I guess I could start, like, you know, Tennis Gate and defend this Russian guy or something. It's totally bizarre, and I'm sure we're going to get even more deeply into how bizarre and disturbing it all is when Matt talks to Brianna later. All right, but we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with Danny McLean to talk about the midterm elections and voter suppression. We'll be right back.
Yeah. Welcome. Welcome you. Hey. I'm your big brother. What do I have to say to the kids?
Let go. Life does get tough. No need to stress. Hold you back too much. Let's go. I heard they found the solution. But where you be for the revolution?
What I say to the kids?
Wake up, things might get rough. No need to stress. Keeps you down too much. Wake up, I heard they found a solution. But where you be for the revolution?
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Danny McLean. She's a contributor at TheNation.com and a fellow at the Nation Institute. Danny, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
It's really good to have you on. So you have a recent piece written for The Nation called Why Black Women Are the Voting Bloc to Watch in the Midterm Elections. And explain why that is. Help set the conversation for us.
Sure. So when you look at, kind of to take a look at why this is such an important question to be asking right now, there's always concern that folks won't head to the polls, that progressive voters won't head to the polls for midterm elections. There is, particularly with this midterm, according to a recent NBC poll, only about 50% of those polled said that they are highly interested in the midterm election. So there's this general, question about who's actually going to turn out
right.
to cast, to cast their votes. And it's so critical, right, because there's a concern that the Dems may lose the Senate to the Republicans. Right now, I think, according to 538, there's something like a 60% chance that the Republicans will gain control of the Senate. So, this is, the 538 puts the odds at 61%. According to the New York Times, they're saying there's about a 71% chance that the Republicans will gain control. So who's going to turn out? When you look at the 2008 and 2012 elections, you see that black women were incredibly reliable voters. They had the highest voter turnout of any segment in the country in both of those, in our most recent presidential elections. In 2012, young black women had the highest voter turnout of all young voters between the ages of 18 and 29.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to, so we know that among progressive voters, black women are the most kind of reliable and consistent. And beyond just getting themselves to the polls, there's also the belief that black women are influencers, that, in addition to heading out to vote themselves, they make sure that their children vote, that their you know, siblings vote, that they're, you know, they're holding important conversations within their families and communities about the importance of voting.
That's really
interesting. There's also alongside this a concern, you know, because, you know, one of the reasons black folks turned out in such large numbers, in 08 and 12 is because many people are incredibly inspired by and motivated by President Obama. So what does it mean, you know, in the midterm that clearly he's not on the ticket? Will people be inspired to turn out and vote in such large numbers?
Right. So there's a lot there. I want to get to, you know, I think one of the things that definitely has been a problem in terms of framing this midterm is, you know, there doesn't seem to be a kind of national democratic message. You have, and part of that does reflect very different realities of the states that candidates are competing in. Obviously, to win re-election as a Democrat in Alaska versus North Carolina, you know, versus Hawaii are going to mean different
right.
things. But that said, there still has not really congealed a kind of clear message, really, other than maybe, you know, these Republicans are obviously really extreme and really crazy, and you need to sort of come out and sort of hold the line against that. But that said, I mean, and I think specifically when you're talking about the agendas of African-American women or other really key parts of a progressive coalition, one of the things that you really do need is really clear stances on healthcare, as an example, probably sharpening the focus on, and what we sort of relentlessly advocate for on this show, which is basically, you know, economic populism, progressive economic policies. How is that balance in terms of mobilizing black women voters from a message of basically, right, without the inspiration of being able to vote for President Obama, and then you're kind of saying, look, you need to go out and vote for maybe some Democrat that you've never even heard of, or maybe when you have, you've seen them sort of, you know, their politics are not particularly, you know, inspiring or distinct. But you need to vote to hold back like this really horrible wave of Republicans versus a proactive progressive agenda for the midterms, which, I mean, I don't think you're really seeing from national Democrats. Are there other organizations that are mobilizing black female
right.
voters that are speaking to those issues? Like, how is that being addressed?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's an incredibly important point. And, I've talked to women who are engaged in voter organizing efforts in, let's see, I talked to someone who's in the Detroit area. I talked to someone who's in Milwaukee. And then I talked to someone who works with Color of Change, which is a national racial justice organization that focuses on the black community. And I think one thing that was a consistent, you know, message that I heard from all of them is that, you know, what matters and what works is being in touch with voters in general, but they're, you know, particularly focused on black women all year round, so that you don't have to come out, you know, 3 weeks before the election and make a case about why it's important to get to the polls. Instead, for example, I talked to a woman named Sarah Noble, who is the director of something called the Reproductive Justice Collective in Milwaukee. And she and her colleagues have been in touch. You know, they do year-round civic engagement organizing work. So all year round, you know, they're talking to people in communities, particularly women. Most recently, their push has been around education around the Affordable Care Act. Mm. So with changes to who's eligible for Medicaid, they're standing in front of grocery stores. As the window starts to close for the enrollment period, they're talking to people about, okay, you may have gotten some kind of complicated information, but, you know, here's what you need to be thinking about in terms of, you know, where your family falls in terms of income and what you're eligible for, you know, in terms of health insurance. So, and similarly, I talked to someone in the Detroit area who directs an organization called Mothering Justice. So you begin to see this commonality around, you know, some of these organizations, based on their names, it may sound like they're focused specifically on reproductive health and on kind of moms, but they're really using that opening to have much broader conversations with people about political involvement and their families, you know, well-being. Danielle Atkinson in the Detroit area, you know, they're having conversations with black moms, moms of color throughout Michigan about economic justice issues. So affordable child care, raising the minimum wage. They just, you know, feel like they've had a victory around that you know, recently there in Michigan. So they're really focused on the bread and butter issues and starting, you know, having, facilitating these conversations all year round so that then when you show up on someone's doorstep in mid-October to encourage them to go to the polls on November 4th, it's not the first time that they're meeting you. You know, you've been building a conversation about why political engagement is really bigger than just this one candidate who you may not find particularly motivating. You realize how this candidate is going to connect to these broader issues that you know you care about and that are, you know, really affect your family and your community. So I think the key is this idea of year-round civic engagement and having organizers who see the importance of that so that they're not just making an ask of someone on the eve of the election and, you know, expecting that that person is going to show up because it's their civic duty to go to the polls. It's a bigger conversation than that.
Right, so that voting and elections are part of life, really. I mean, not just the sort of exceptional event that, well, all of a sudden we're interested in hearing you and your concerns because we literally need you to do something in a couple of weeks. Yeah, I mean, that's really
right.
Important. I mean, the one other thing I'd like to ask you about is, specifically in the South, in North Carolina and in Georgia, this Moral Mondays. I mean, are you
right.
seeing that playing a role, like really constructively in mobilizing people in those elections?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really curious. You know, I spent some time in North Carolina in May when the legislative session reopened there in Raleigh because I was curious about how Moral Mondays was going to continue after all of the great strides that it had made in the summer of 2013. So I think that's a perfect example of, you know, you have tens of thousands of people who have been mobilized over the course of the past, you know, year and a half around the broader political issues of what does it mean for Republicans to be in control, not just of the governor's mansion, but also both houses of the legislature. And you have this, I mean, it was incredible doing reporting there because these people have really formed these tight kinships.
Yeah.
And really see, you know, themselves as, you know, family. And they support one another, and they're having these incredible political conversations and setting an agenda for the future of their state. So, of course, I'm fascinated, you know, very curious to see how that's going to translate into the, what's that going to mean for Kay Hagan? Like, how's that going to translate into what happens in the race for the Senate there? So I think Moral Mondays is a great example of kind of that kind of year-long civic participation and voter education that we're going to see on November 4th, how that translates into activity at the polls.
Yeah, and you know, even beyond that, I think specifically talking about the South and a candidate like Kay Hagan, what's fascinating too is, you know, obviously, you know, the South usually has produced these Democratic candidates. There is some kind of history of some economic populism there, and then there's obviously African-American candidates from different congressional districts. But what's really interesting is Moral Mondays is kind of showing that, in some respects, when is that equation going to flip in the South where someone like Kay Hagan realizes it's actually much more profitable to sort of like activate this new Southern coalition than spend all my time trying to assure a more, you know, conservative possible voter in a swing district that I like, I'm not going to touch his guns or something.
Mm-hmm.
It might actually be
mm-hmm.
more relevant in terms of, you know, durable electoral success to see what's happening at Moral Mondays. I mean, I'm not saying it's there yet, but that is where it's going. And then you have the possibility of, you know, the Southern Democratic parties could start being like significantly more progressive, maybe even than other regional parts of the Democratic Party. It's really interesting.
It is. It's fascinating, and I think you make a really good point. I also think it's important to, you know, the Times had a piece over the weekend comparing, you know, a Kay Hagan to a Mary Landrieu in terms of how they're running their campaigns,
right.
Talking about Southern Democrats. You know, so at least Kay Hagan, like, stands with Planned Parenthood and,
right.
You know, talks very openly about being in favor of a woman's right to choose and uses that to push back against Tom Tillis and say, this is what, you know, this man has, is clearly anti-choice, and you know, I'm standing by my convictions and by my principles, and I support a woman's right to choose, versus Mary Landrieu, who has these very kind of nuanced, as, you know, as Times put it, you know, she is certainly kind of backing away from taking strong stances on issues like same-sex marriage, a lot of choice issues. So I think you raise a really interesting point. I also think it's important to look at, you know, the context, the political context in which people are operating and how much room they may feel like they have to move on these issues.
Oh, yeah, no question about that. You know, the other important thing to definitely raise, obviously, when you're talking about activating, you know, black woman voters or really any voter from, you know, Hispanic voters, black voters, is, you know, this campaign of voter suppression. We saw over the weekend the Supreme Court overruling an earlier lower court ruling on Texas's voter ID laws. What was fascinating about the first ruling was that, you know, it wasn't just struck down because it was a poorly constructed law or something like that. The lower court went broader and said, no, this really is the intention of this bill is to keep certain people from voting. It's pretty rare, as you know, that a court would actually say something that bluntly. But this, you know, Supreme Court went along with what its record on voting rights has been, which is completely atrocious, and sort of overturned it and restored what Texas was doing. I guess the theory in 2012, and it seems to have been borne out in some ways, was that because of how aggressive these efforts were, there was backlash in communities that were the targets of these voter suppression efforts, and people ended up voting in even higher numbers. I guess it's a two-part question. Of one is, do you think that that's possible that something like that could play out again in the midterms? And then at the same time, you know, more broadly, how does the strategy to restore voting rights, you know, fit into these efforts as well?
Yeah. You know, I think I was actually, you know, very interested to watch in advance of the 2012 election all of the organizing that happened, incredible organizing on the parts of civil rights organizations, groups like the Advancement Project. I mean, so many groups just mobilized to call out, you know, voter ID laws, the voter suppressions in Ohio, in Pennsylvania. And I think because of the education they were doing around, this is what these voter ID laws will mean for you, you know, elderly black woman who doesn't drive and so, you know, who doesn't have this particular type of ID, or, you know, woman who has changed your name and so has to kind of jump through all of these hoops to locate the records necessary to get this new type of ID. I think you're right. I think there was a kind of hyper-awareness around the power of the votes of people of color that did motivate people and that brought folks out to the polls in large numbers. I don't have the stats in front of me, so I'm kind of just speaking on maybe, you know, my sense of the kind of energy that I felt.
I don't have them in front of me either, but I think that was borne out. I think it was, you know, I do think it was true. Yeah. Go ahead.
And so I think when we look at what's happening right now, you know, I mentioned speaking with Sarah Noble at the Milwaukee Reproductive Justice Collective. One of the ways, I mentioned the work that she and her colleagues have been doing around the Affordable Care Act and educating around that. The other huge piece of their work has been educating voters around, you know, the Wisconsin voter ID law, which the Supreme Court, you know, they blocked, you know. So you talked about what's happened in Texas, the very sad news of, you know, that law being upheld. In Wisconsin, you know, there's the Supreme Court has issued an injunction, you know, against the voter ID law there, so it won't go into effect, at least for this election. And the Reproductive Justice Collective has been, you know, out in canvassing, sending mailings, holding forums, doing emergency phone banks through this whole process of the legal, you know, ins and outs, telling people what they will need to bring to the polls. And I think, you know, that has led to, again, this sense of like, wow, they really must not want us to vote if it's this much rigmarole around this. I think similarly, I talked to Arisha Hatch, who's a managing director of campaigns at Color of Change, and they are engaging their members in pushing back in Georgia and calling on Georgia's Secretary of State to deal with this, you know, 50,000 voter registrations that are backlogged, somehow lost. So I think we're seeing some of the same kinds of organizing where people, you know, really want voters to know this kind of coordinated effort to put all of these bizarre requirements and restrictions in place to keep them away from the polls.
Absolutely. Well, the piece is Why Black Women Are the Voting Bloc to Watch in the Midterms. Danny McLean, she's a contributing writer at TheNation.com and a fellow at the Nation Institute. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. We are going to make the switch, and Matt is going to speak with Brianna Wu. We will be back in a moment.
All right, we are back. This is the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder, and joining me now is Brianna Wu. She's the head of development for Giant Space Cat and the host of gaming podcast Isometric on 5x5. Brianna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here. I'm a huge fan.
Oh, thank you. So, Brianna, let's get right to it. Can I ask you a question? Are you home right now?
I can't talk about my current location yet. It's not safe for me. So that's
all I needed to hear, because I want you to explain why is it that that's the case.
So, I'm well known as a woman that you know, speaks up for women in tech. You know, my day job, I am a software engineer. You know, I develop video games. But increasingly, you know, I've spoken up more and more about, you know, women in tech issues. I don't know if your listeners know much about Gamergate. That's, you know, it's a terrible thing that's happening right now in the video game industry. But it's basically this machine that comes through and harasses and terrorizes different women in this field. You know, they've been going after my friends, and, you know, it finally came after me. I posted a joke about Gamergate on my Twitter, and, you know, it escalated to the point that I was having death threats sent to me and my home address posted. Your listeners can read this online, but some really, really horrific things that were said to me. Things like, you know, they're going to, you know, castrate my husband, choke me to death on the parts, murder my children, if I have any, because they're going to grow up to be feminists too. Shove a K-bar in between certain parts of my body, you know, rape me in various places until I bleed to death. You know, all of this right there along my home address. So, you know, I've had the FBI, I've had the Cyber Crimes Division here in Massachusetts look into it. It's a very scary situation. And, you know, I can't talk about an ongoing investigation, but I can tell you, like, this was serious enough that I can't tell your listeners where I am right now.
So give listeners who might not be familiar with it a little background on what at least in your views, and, you know, I've talked about it on this show, and
sure,
and there's a few listeners who have a hard time separating Gamergate from their identity of being a gamer. I guess
right.
They just hear the term gamer, they see it in Gamergate, and they assume, you know, these people are me. But sadly, for, you know, it would be nice if that was the case, but that's not true. So give a little background on what Gamergate is.
So, you know, Gamergate is a new word for a phenomenon that's been happening for quite a while. You know, it was ostensibly named by Adam Baldwin, who, by the way, sent, you know, 200,000 of his Twitter followers after me last week. But it's a name that's been given for a movement. This all started when basically a former boyfriend of a good friend of mine, Zoe Quinn, became a very jilted lover and posted all kinds of private details about her sex life on the internet with transcripts, secretly, you know, recorded her, and basically put all this dirt out there for the world to see. So what you saw is this movement rising up against that, saying like, oh, well, Zoe is game journalism is corrupt. It's corrupt. It's corrupt. It's corrupt. You know, they were attacking Zoe for allegedly, you know, sleeping with the person that worked at Kotaku for better reviews of her game. Only if you start looking into the facts of it, Kotaku never, you know, and this journalist never reviewed her game. It really says everything you need to know about the movement, that they went after my friend Zoe and not the journalists as being accused of this. So what you basically have is it's this machine at this point. And they say, oh, we're about, you know, gaming ethics. Oh, we want to change gaming ethics. And it's a pretext that works. It's very effective at kind of rallying support with gamers. Because like you say, I'm a gamer. Many of your audiences are probably gamers. So it encourages people to, you know, to care about journalistic ethics. The reality is these are people, they're very upset about women that are speaking up for issues about how women are treated in the video game industry. This includes Anita Sarkeesian is a huge target. Zoe Quinn is a huge target. Lee Alexander is a huge target. And what you have is this machine that started bullying, harassing, threatening to rape, destroying the credibility, you know, undermining the career of women in tech one by one. They've done it to my friend Samantha Allen. They bullied her until she left the industry. They did this to my friend Jen Frank. They went after her, harassed until she quit the industry. They did it to Maddie Bryce. And they're going through and taking out every single prominent woman in this field one by one.
As someone who's in the industry, as a video game developer, can you tell me a little bit about what it's like being in this industry and being a woman, because I mean, this is obviously coming from a place that started way before Adam Baldwin coined the term hashtag Gamergate.
Right. I think you have to look at the entire culture of video games. You know, video games are a field that, by the way, I love them. If you come to my house, you're going to see 300, 400, 500 video games on my shelf. Like, I am as much a gamer as anyone can be. But the problem with the industry is, as early as like the 80s, you have had this culture that tells gamers that this is a place for men, by men. I mean, how many times have you played a game where some girl is kidnapped and you've got to go save her? Or a girl is murdered and that gives the hero like the impetus to go on a blood-filled vengeance crusade?
Oh, so, almost all the time, yeah.
Yeah, all the time. So you're getting these messages over and over and over. They're like, this is a space for men. And it has consequences for everyone at all levels of the industry. If you're just a female player and you play, say, Xbox Live and play Halo or Left 4 Dead or something like that, you will be harassed based on your gender. It's happened to so many women I know, to the point that most women I know won't participate in Xbox Live.
As a casual gamer, my experience with this is literally, I know girls who play video games, and they play video games that aren't, you know, iPhone games. They play actual Xbox Live games, and they're good. But they literally, when they play online, they can't use the headphone set that I, as a male, just take as, oh, I could just talk to these people while I'm playing. I could tell them about, oh, watch out for the guy behind you. But these women that I know can't even do that, because the second they hear these other players, who are usually mostly male, hear their voice, they treat them completely differently and not always that great.
Yep. It's happened to me 100 times. It's happened to women I know all the time. So, yeah, that's the I hate to use the term lower rung of the ladder, but you know what I mean, the consumer base.
Yes, of course.
If you move up the ladder, so let's go one more level up the ladder. Let's say you're a game journalist. You know, it is really scary how few women are able to work as game journalists in this industry. If you look at IGN, I think, as I understand right now, they have two women that are on staff, and one of them is a model. You know, and I'm not trying to diss Naomi Kyle. I have tremendous professional respect for her, but that's who's out there for the public. If you look at Giant Bomb, they choose to have no diversity. They have no black people. They have no gay people. They have no Hispanics. They have no women. They are one. They are a major, major, major site that makes a choice for all their editors, all their senior editors, all their people that, you know, are kind of outside the office, their video editors. Everyone is a white, straight man. So you have this system where it's mostly men judging everything that the industry creates and writing the media about it. So this has huge consequences too. It's had consequences with Gamergate, as all of the men that work at this publication, they have the option of just sitting on the sidelines because it frankly doesn't really affect them. So you have like the women in the field are being taken out and there's no press coverage about it. So that happens. If you move one step higher up the ladder and say women that work at game companies, I know so many women that have faced sexual harassment, that have faced gender-based harassment, that are talked down to. I have a very good friend of mine that worked for one of the biggest studios that exists. She actually had to come up with strategies to have her ideas actually heard at meetings, because that's how much the men there would talk over her. I have another friend of mine that used to work at Harmonix. They were hiring a software engineer and they kept using the pronoun he. This person, he should have X qualification. She asked them not to do that and they just shot her down. So at that rung of the ladder, you have all this unconscious bias against women. At the very top of the ladder, women that actually own our own companies or are very high public figures in tech, the barriers I face every single day at my company are horrible. I had a meeting with one of the three major console makers recently about bringing my game Revolution 60 to one of the three major consoles you can have in your home. This meeting was ended by them laughing at the work I do for women in tech and choosing to never follow up with the things that they said that they were going to do. I tried to call them and talk to them like, hey, I felt like that was unprofessional for you to laugh at these public speaking engagements
and
I do.
And you're talking about this is because of the advocacy you work for women in tech.
Right. In my day job, I'm a software engineer. I produce software. Like many other geeks, I'm happiest when I'm staring at my glowing rectangle and writing code and making things. But I'm also deeply troubled by the way women are treated in this field. So I do speak out on it. I do a lot of public speaking events. You know, I write high-profile articles. This person laughed at that work and was very threatened about it. And when I tried to pull him aside, this is someone that's a major figure at a public company. When I tried to pull him aside and say, hey, I kind of felt that was unprofessional, he just shot me down and never talked to me again. So what I'm telling you is at every single level of this industry, we have systematic, extremely difficult problems. And what makes it worse is the women that stand up and try to get the industry address it. We're currently being systematically targeted and publicly destroyed by this machine. Does that make sense, Steve?
Oh, it absolutely does. And I think it's actually broader than just the video game industry. I mean, many industries treat women this way, but I would say one that's obviously been talked about a lot recently is basically the overarching tech industry, which I guess video games falls under. You know, startup culture, whether you're developing hardware, software, whether you're creating cell phones or computers or products for that. I mean, what you just mentioned is pretty much what women are their experiences in all these different subsets of tech culture.
Absolutely. I mean, look at my friend Julianne Horvath, who I consider her a dear friend and a hero of mine. I don't know if your listeners heard about this or saw this, but she brought up some extremely serious allegations of gender-based harassment at GitHub. GitHub is a version control software. It is used at all levels of the industry. It is a wonderful tool that any professional software developer uses. She brought up extremely disturbing, you know, allegations of gender-based harassment that made my stomach churn and most other women in the industry. What happened when she brought this up? And this isn't in games. This is in the wider tech industry. Well, she had people go through and question her sex life, dig up lots of dirt about that, attack her credibility, bully her. She ended up leaving her job. And, you know, the person that was at the center of, you know, the allegations that she made, that man ended up just quitting the job and getting a bigger job. So, you know, it's a very frustrating situation for women at all levels of tech right now. And I just really want to stress this. We are not asking for some crazy Orwellian future where you can't make games with sexy women or getting rid of Call of Duty or anything like that. What I advocate is just companies looking at their culture and hiring more women and also treating the women that are there better, like raising awareness of what men in this field sometimes do to women that feels hostile. That's what I advocate. Like, this is a very reasonable thing, but it's so threatening by these men that have this unconscious privilege don't want to think about it. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And, you know, I've seen you say that, too, about specifically have to – I mean, it's ridiculous you have to point it out because no sane, intellectual person is reading what these advocates for opening up these cultures, you know, tech, geek culture, video games to more women to make it a safe space for them. No one's advocating for video games to drop the sexy women. No one's advocating for video games to drop these tropes that are being complained about or being critiqued. No one's asking these, you know, Call of Duty, like you said, to be banned. You've said it. I've seen you say it in the various different media outlets you've spoken to, online, on your Twitter. I mean, I feel like we're breaking news, though, to these Gamergate audience because they don't – it's like they have blinders on and they don't see that you're saying this. All you're asking is that there also be, you know, an acceptance for people who don't want to see just those type of games. There be an acceptance and a space for people who just don't want to partake in the culture that says, you know, you can't do this, you can't play this, you can't take full advantage of every aspect of gaming because the culture won't accept you.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the trick, isn't it? Like, they have to turn what I and other women are advocating into some extremist, loony, bananas position, because what we're actually advocating is so darn reasonable, you know?
Dead Spin had a great article about how this Gamergate issue basically is a look at the culture wars. And I mean, we've seen this with things like even the film industry. And I mean, there's been advocates saying, you know, we want more women superheroes being portrayed in movies. We want women in strong protagonist leading roles where they're not just like in video games, the object to be saved by a man. And it's not like we haven't seen adventure and action movies that still do this. We do. But there actually is movies that are geared towards, you know, here is a strong woman, female character. Here's a strong woman in a movie. And it's, to me, it's just weird that, you know, I'm sure that has been blowback, of course, but you just didn't see the same amount. And I mean, right there is the evidence to these gamers who have a problem with what you're advocating for, that other mediums have done this. And they've done it without getting rid of what they're so worried about being censored.
I mean, it's deeply disturbing. It feels like at this point, these tropes that the white man is the hero are so, it's everywhere in our culture to the point we don't even see it anymore. And you brought up superhero movies. Let's sit here and think about this for a minute. What are the major superhero movies that have come out? Superman, Batman, Punisher, Daredevil, Hulk, Iron Man, Captain America. You know, over and over and over and over and over. It's this story of the man or a group of men going and having an adventure. And it's like they have a checkbox there and they say, well, we have one woman there and there we go. Well, I have news for you. Women are half the freaking planet. And I'm tired of being put in this little checkbox in these stories for someone to go save. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. It has huge consequences for what girls grow up and think that they can be or do. All I'm asking for, like, I realize that like getting to 50% is not a realistic goal within my lifetime. But for instance, programming, if you look at programming and video games, across tech as a whole, women make up about 20% of programming jobs. But if you look at games, we only make up 3% of programming jobs. That is the same skills, the same resume, the same background. The exact same person could work those two jobs, but there's a drastic drop in women that work in video games. And I think we've got to start looking at why. And if I can say one more thing, like, this is really, really, really important for our future. There are all kinds of power in the world that you can have. You could be a celebrity. You can be an elected official. You can be a journalist like yourself with an audience. Another way to have power is to be a software engineer. Increasingly, software engineering is the architecture of our society that defines how we interact with each other. Like, it's the key to the future. And when you lock women out of that career path, it has real consequences for what happens to women overall. Look at Twitter. Twitter has a horrible, horrible reputation for just turning a blind eye to the kind of death and rape threats that I get routinely. When I went to Twitter this year, I had a party I went to at their company, and it was a bunch of white men that I met. If they had more women working on that team, I think you would see more awareness and different policies. So, you know, this is a very reasonable thing to fight for.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because as an advocate for this, I mean, I was out to a number of people for many months just to generally talk about the online harassment women face. And these are not just video game people I went out to. And the issue is that some people, for very good reasons, just don't want to put themselves out there because they've been attacked for their advocacy, their lives put in danger, such as yourself. And it's stifled a lot of this conversation. And I mean, that's what they want. So I want to thank you really for being one of those people. I mean, Gamergate has done a real hatchet job there trying to shut you up, because they've really, I mean, really, they've been, I've seen what they've been doing. And then they try to, when they realize they can't do it, they turn around and they say, you know, well, she's just looking for attention. Which, I mean, you know, so what though? Like, even if that is, So what? You're looking for attention for a very real issue that you felt
I'm
strongly
looking
about.
To stop these bullies from taking out my friends one by one. I want to go through this for your listener. This has been my year this year, just to be clear. They went after my friend Julianne Horvath. They tried to destroy her and bully her out of the industry. In July, they went after my friend Samantha Allen. They were in their same playbook. They harassed her. They threatened her. They went through her past. They tried to professionally discredit her. They tried to get her fired until the point she said, there are easier ways to make a living, and just quit the industry. And we lost a powerful voice. They did that exact same thing to Jen Frank. They did it to Maddie Bryce. They did it to my friend Zoe Quinn. They went through. They investigated her sex life. They try to destroy her credibility. They harass her. They organize things to like give her harassment at PAX this year, which is a terribly important professional event. They did it to my friend Lee Alexander. They've done it to my friend Anita Sarkeesian. And they're going after us one by one by one by one by one. So if you want to say I want attention for that, yeah, screw you. I'm trying to stand up to these people that are literally terrorizing my friends and other women in the industry to the point we don't want to work here anymore. And it's got to stop. This is ridiculous.
And you what I especially like is I was reading in your recent interview with The Guardian, and that you mm-hmm. bring this up, and I think it's fantastic because there's broader implications here. There's people mm-hmm. who may be sick and tired of the Gamergate conversation because they don't really care about video gaming or video games. They didn't really notice this broader implication until maybe the death threats came through and people's real lives were threatened, and then maybe they started paying attention. But you really get to the broader implications here because you're talking about policy, and you're not just talking about policy as in corporate policy, company policy, policy within the video game industry. You mention in your piece that you and Zoe Quinn are both represented by Senator Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts,
yes.
and how you've reached out to her. Because this is a real issue. There needs to be some sort of legislation that protects women. And again, I want to say, cut off these Gamergate people now before they start saying how, you're censoring me. Why can't I call someone fat on the internet? Why can't I call someone ugly on the internet? But you know what? As bad and disgusting you are for saying those things, you aren't the people we're talking about here. What we're
right.
talking about here are the very real death threats, the very real personal attacks that look for personal information, for addresses and family and relatives and friends and places of work and home addresses, work addresses, etc. And then they send a very detailed list of what they want to do to you, as at the top of this interview you mentioned. So very briefly, if you can, talk about the legislation that you'd like to see and what you'd work toward and what your ideal your work towards that will ideally lead to, because that to me is the real matter here, because that's where something's going to get done. That's where this issue
right.
will really make a change, and people will realize, you know, this Gamergate thing was something that happened and was important, and not just a bunch of nerds saying mean things to women on the internet. Get over it. It happens. It's the internet. Because it's more than that.
No, it absolutely is. And yeah, I want to be really clear here. I'm a technology professional. I was very disturbed by, you know, what Edward Snowden brought to light, and I am tremendously disturbed by the penchant our government has shown under the Obama administration for spying on its citizens. So for me, this really conflicts me. Because on one hand, I do think privacy is a tremendously important issue. And I don't want to live in a world where the government has even more power to spy on its citizens without a warrant. I fully stand against that. On the same time, I think if you look at 8chan, 8chan is a hate site. Academics have called it a hate site. They've looked into the stats and what they do. You can look at the definitions of what a hate group is. This is a place that people plan attacks to, you know, libel and discredit and to hurt the reputation of women, and in illegal ways. With death, it's not just death threats, it's not just harassment, it's spreading lies. For instance, you can go on 8chan and see a template that they are spreading around to make fake tweets that I've said, and they have this template there. So then they make up this thing saying, I made fun of someone that's autistic. I would never do that, but they keep repeat. It's just like the Republicans, repeat, 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 repeat the lie, show the picture. So I think that we need someone that is a lawyer and not a software engineer to look at the jurisprudence behind this issue and to come up with some solutions here. And that, you know, I want to tell you, I am in, you know, contact with Senator Warren's office. I am in touch with my congressional representative here in Boston. I can tell you, I expect to speak to the White House soon about this. So I think we need people that understand these issues better than I do to come up with a way to compel these sites to hold them legally accountable. Like, if you're not going to store the owner's IP address, well, let's make the actual person running the server accountable. Like, this is not a Boolean variable. Either we have privacy or we have free attacks on women. I think, like, we can come to some compromise here because the status quo is going to, you know, chase women out of this field. I have to say this to your listeners, and this brings me to tears every single time I talk about it. You know, my friend Zoe Quinn, who's the person that was the first target of, you know, what coalesced into Gamergate, I was talking to her, and she has a folder on her computer called The Ones We've Lost. And it's young girls that have written to her emails saying that they plan to not go into software development because they're too scared of what they see happening to her. And I just burst out into tears because I have a folder on my computer exactly like it. I get emails from women every day that are terrified by the state of this stuff. And if we don't act, we're going to lose another generation of women from this awesome, high-paying career. And it's got to stop.
Brianna Wu, I think you've said it best, and it's best to leave it there. I
absolutely
really appreciate what you do. Keep talking. Keep speaking out. Definitely... I really think the legislation issue, I think that's fantastic and really should, I mean, if anything, the naysayers who don't care about this or those who just don't understand it or how it broadly affects the culture or people's lives, I mean, right there, I mean, the internet's not a safe place for women right now. And that extends to different industries in that tech world. And I think you're doing great work. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I promise your listeners, we will make this better for their daughters. We will do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
Sword fair, man.
Michael with
That's my Gamergate impression. We still got the Obama Gamergate character, but now I am personifying Gamergaters.
And We've received emails about this.
Yeah. Death threats are bad, whatever. Anyways, look. If you threaten my ability to kill hookers in video games, where does it stop?
I mean, apparently we've lost members, too, over... Not even us talking about Gamergate. I'm sure there's an audience who hate it and think it's bad, but are just sick of the issue, which I completely understand. There are people who I've spoken to...
I certainly understand. No, but let me say, I think that she did a really... good job of outlining. I mean, I think there's a couple of different steps to this story, right? Like, one of the reason you take Sam Harris seriously is because he has a serious platform and he actually influences people. I wouldn't go, you know, scrolling around obscure atheist message boards for dumb comments and harassment of Muslims. So, you know, there's always the thing of like, okay, there's a million subcultures online. Many of them engage in many ugly things, and we're not going to cover all of them, right? But at the same time, as soon as you get to actually threatening people's lives and livelihoods and well-being, then that becomes a different thing. And then what this whole thing has really shown is it's like it's just it encapsulates a lot. It shows a lot. And even in the tech industry, you know, there was never – until the mid-80s, you know, programming used to actually be pretty gender equal in terms of as many women were in the game as men. And so all of this stuff has a history and a context, and it is just kind of amazing. And again, I'm really upfront that I am speaking as someone who's totally not a gamer. I know very little, and I know I make jokes about, you know, get some sun, take a run or whatever, which I mean. But you know, look, whatever, that's great. That's your passion. That's cool. But to blow by the fact that people can't be in their homes and what this has really turned into and the massacre threat on Anita Sarkeesian is just it says and shows a lot way beyond your particular concern for your particular platform.
I mean, there's a point where you would think someone would say, like, even if you are completely 100% believing that Gamergate started with good intentions, which it didn't, but let's just leave it. Let's leave it into that world, that alternative reality where Gamergate started with good intentions. The movement at this point has clearly been co-opted. And to be part of this movement that, again, in this alternative reality, that turned into a movement that harasses women and sends them fleeing from their homes, to be a part of that movement now is supporting the actions of that movement. I mean, it's that simple. Drop it. Come up with something new. And go after the video game journalistic...
That's another thing I'd add. Because, again, I don't know anything. I know very little about this whole subculture. But I looked into... first of all, it's just taken as reality that whatever the... I forget the girl's name. That, you know, she slept with journalists for coverage.
Zoe Quinn.
That has never... And people have sent me stuff, because as soon as I tweeted about this, I got a gazillion tweets coming at me. The reason you don't have proof that she got coverage for sleeping with guys is because the guy she supposedly slept with didn't cover her game. So that's like – you can't just – I mean, if you have some type of secret knowledge that she slept with them and then they sent somebody a text and that – you know, bring it forward. But you can't just keep repeating something that has no reality to it. And then looking around more, I mean, it seems like actually – video game journalism is actually pretty compromised by the relationship between corporations and game developers and all of these websites. So you got a great issue there. So why don't you focus on it and leave these women alone?
Well, that's because companies like, you know, EA make the games that they want to play. So it's okay that they push. Okay that they push.
Before we go to the fun half, folks.
Oh, wow. We have to
because
to
we
half.
Are
yes.
losing members. because of this. Michigas.
To be fair, it's also the Sam Harris stuff, too.
Oh, no. I'm losing we're not many members
We're not the fans of atheists and gamers right now.
If you are really committed to killing hookers in video games or you are a Sam Harris devotee, you have been very mad at us the last couple of weeks. The Sam Harris people are amazing, though, because they're like – it's like
– it's a religion to them.
It is a religion to them. And also what's funny is the way they – I really have enjoyed, though, that our audience has a lot of people who actually agree that Sam Harris's policy views are totally disastrous, but for some reason still think that I'm being unfair to him. I hesitate to even say this. I'm sure it will come up again in the fun half, but I will – at least the Gamergate people – it's delusional, but within its delusion, it's coherent. The Sam Harris people are like, well, you're right, but you're totally unfair.
To be honest, I'm not sure which is more scary.
I don't know which is – whatever. We'll figure it out.
Maybe, but anyways, maybe there's not one that outdoes the other. Maybe
the point
they're just both.
Is that even if you love Sam Harris and video games, you can still love us. And if you're not part of the Sam Harris cult or the
video game
whatever – it's probably a great time to become a member of the Majority Report.
We're moving soon, too,
and
folks.
And we're moving. We're leaving. We're going to different digs. We don't have to do the whole spiel. Become a member today. Go to Majority
Report. Join the Majority Report.
Yeah.
Join the MajorityReport.com. Leave us a good review on iTunes. 5 stars, 4 stars, whatever you feel. Leave us a little comment, too, so people can see your opinion on the show. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMajorityReport. Follow us on Twitter, @MajorityFM. Subscribe to us on YouTube, youtube.com/SamCedar. Connect your Facebook and Twitter account to donateyouraccount.com, and you can send out a tweet every day from The Majority Report that supports us by promoting to your fans, friends, and followers one video or podcast a day. It's that simple. Get your friends into the show while also educating them on whatever topic we're covering that day. You can also support this show by buying all of your stuff through the Amazon link at MajorityReportKickback.com. You see no difference. You pay the same price you would on Amazon, except when you go through that link, Amazon's got to share their cut with us. You can also, here's a win-win, Buy fair trade coffee and chocolates at justcoffee.coop. That's justcoffee.coop. Use coupon code MAJORITY for 10% off your entire order. Support a great company, fair trade. What else?
I just thought of a great win-win for everybody. I mean, besides, obviously, in all seriousness, the coffee is a real win-win for everybody. Go on Amazon. You buy Letter to a Christian Nation.
Whoa, you sounded like you were you sounded like you were going to Scotty B voice for a second.
You buy freaking Sam Harris's books. You like two of them or whatever you want. You read his little like rehashing of positivism in his own particular boring way, and you read it. You feel superior to everybody, and then you're so angry because there's Muslims running around and people are still religious or whatever, and you don't have a date tonight. So then you might want to decompress by playing a video game. So you order World of Warcraft, and you do all of it through the Majority Report link.
Oh,
and even
that.
Though you're mad at us, you still realize you like us 90% of the time. You give us a little cut, and you give a cut to the violent video games or whatever else you like, and Sam Harris can keep going around and supplementing his trust fund with his boring books.
Listen, if Scott Brown could support us,
dude,
then I mean a gamer and an atheist could easily support us.
Dude.
All right.
We will see you
in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
Is all that set up?
Yeah, I'm setting that up now. You can call us. Talk to me about Gamergate. Talk to Michael about Sam Harris and Islam.
Or not.
Call us for something else. Tell us what's going on in your hometown.
What's going on in your neck of the woods? Yeah. All right, see you in the fun.
What are you, Al Roker?
I don't know.
Oh, that's his little catchphrase. Yeah.
I heard Carmela Soprano.
What's happening in
Carmela
your neck
Soprano
of the woods.
Said that once. That's where I know it.
All right. See you in the better half.
Set an apple pie.